Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 59 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the novelist Jane Fever examines the nostalgic impulse and its relationship with the pastoral and celebrates their combined creative power. Following Jane, the novelist Catherine McMahon considers the role that location plays in historical fiction and at what point a writer should go out and explore it. First up, here's Jane Fever with
A Green Thought in a Green Shade, Another Version of Pastoral. When I was 9, my family, 4 siblings, a mother and father, moved from the northeast of England to London. My parents kept on the cottage in a moorland valley of Northumberland, which they'd bought in the late 1960s, and though with no running water deemed unfit for habitation, it was the place to which we returned for the full duration of every school holiday until I was about 17. As children there, we were mostly outside mapping our territory, Valley of the Dinosaurs, Rabbit Village, building dens and houses in the debris of old barns, finding fluor spar and china in the river, or, on one expedition in an excitingly abandoned cave, a farmer's secret cache of rude magazines. Ted Hughes, in an interview in 1961, described the effect that moving had on him as a child, from the rural town of Mytheroyd, West Yorkshire, to the busier industrial setting of Mexborough. The difference in locality, he says, had the effect of sealing off part of his brain, so that, age 31, he was able to look back on the intensity of those first 7 years spent retrieving for his older animal-hunting brother and describe them as almost half my life. For me, the move south, when I was 9, was cataclysmic. I didn't think I could ever belong, didn't I was reliably informed speak the Queen's language. Jane Fever, a Newcastle geezer, caught her nose in a lemon squeezer. My first kind teacher at Holy Trinity Primary School in Tulse Hill said he thought I looked like the girl in Carrie's War. I did feel like an evacuee. Somewhere in this early onset of self-consciousness, I lost the courage, though not the desire, to write, and didn't begin to try seriously again until, in my mid-30s, around the turn of the last century, the sort of time that seems particularly propitious, I moved from Peckham in South London, where I'd ended up, to a cottage in the middle of nowhere, northwest Devon, called Paradise. Though I was moving to take up a job, my real reason for leaving London was an itch for change, escape perhaps, and the beguiling name of that cottage. My first novel, according to Ruth, was prompted almost entirely by my reconnection with the countryside, the cross-pollination of the reality of the landscape in which I found myself, and the fantasia of the valley in Northumberland locked in my memory. Ruth, the eldest of 4 siblings and narrator of the book, describes the events of one summer during which her parents' marriage and consequently family life falls apart. She reflects, "When a family ends, there's nowhere to go back to. All that is left is the archaeology of it, picking over the disappointing traces of a villa or a Roman fort. It shouldn't be like a death, but somehow it is, not an individual death, but the death of a way of life and of being." The act of writing for Ruth is an act of memorialising. All that is important to me, she says, is to say that it happened, not necessarily in that order, not necessarily like that. These days, nostalgia is commonly used to describe a backward-looking, idealised vision of the past, but it is worth recalling the original use of the word. Coined in the 17th century by a doctor, Johannes Hofer, from the Greek nostos, meaning return home, and algos, meaning pain, it was used to identify a physical ailment he'd observed in Swiss mercenaries. Symptoms of the ailment included weeping, palpitations, anorexia, insomnia, and, overarchingly, an obsessive thinking of home. By 1770, on one of Captain Cook's expeditions, Joseph Banks was recording that most of the crew were pretty far gone with a disease under the name of nostalgia. This latent meaning helps explain the more vitally effective part that nostalgia still plays in our psyches. Home, as Jane Austen demonstrated in Mansfield Park, can be a movable feast. Fanny Price, who's been sent back to the clutter of her original family home in Portsmouth, can be seen to go into a physical decline. Peculiarly fastidious about food and dirt and noise, she longs for the peace and tranquillity of her adopted home of Mansfield Park, which she summons with the partiality of nostalgia from what she now perceives to be its antithesis, the chaos and disorder of Portsmouth. You can be homesick, presumably, if you know or have worked out, like Fanny, where home is. But what if you haven't, or can't? What if that home, like Ruth's, doesn't exist any longer? Even if, as would generally have been the case in the olden days, you didn't move far from your allotted spot, home might well have been deferred for you by the prevailing pastoral ideology of the church, which preached that our true home was the grave, or the life beyond the grave. There is the afterlife, and there is, according to the Greeks, the before life. Shelley's friend, Thomas Hogg, recalls that full of Plato, Shelley accosted a mother and baby on Magdalen Bridge in Oxford, demanding that the infant tell us anything about pre-existence. To Shelley's consternation, the baby appeared to have forgotten how to speak. The idea that all knowledge is reminiscence is suggested too in the brilliant opening to Edward St. Albans' novel, Mother's Milk. Why had they pretended to kill him when he was born? Asked the narrator in the voice of the unnervingly articulate newborn. Maybe, he suggests, the idea was to destroy his nostalgia for the old world. The idea of a pre-existing, idyllic home from which we've been exiled, but to which one day we may return, is a potent one. In times of uncertainty, the pastoral offers a retreat, a sanctuary. When a country is under threat, there's a greater urgency to define quite what it is we are fighting for. Home needs to be a coherent, communally available ideal, and the pastoral represents everything that war, ambition, disruption, industrial fire is not. In a letter of 1942, the novelist, poet and short story writer Sylvia Townsend Warner describes blitzed-out London. St. Clement Danes, she says, is a most romantic ruin, exactly like a Piranesi print. One expects to see hooded shepherds from the Campania sitting around it. Warner's description is a breathtaking example of the way in which the pastoral can be used to sublimate the horror of everyday reality. Her depiction, though, is neither a denial nor a negation of the reality of wartime, but rather a defiant assertion of a purely aesthetic interpretation. Warner proposes the idea of the Piranesi print, the hooded Italian shepherds, as a bracing alternative to the more usual knee-jerk, doom-laden vision of the Blitz, a beautifully literary enactment of the stiff upper lip. For at least 200 years, we've been told that the pastoral, as a location, as a way of life, is on the way out. The villages are dying, the countryside is becoming a theme park. Why then does it persist as a literary recourse? In his wartime essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, George Orwell writes that although the horse plough will give way to the tractor, the country houses will be turned into children's holiday camps, England will still be England, an everlasting animal stretching into the future and the past, and like all living things, having the power to change out of recognition and yet remain the same. Pastoral is England, is home, it is the Ur metaphor. Its unique strength lies in the fact that it is not only the actual retreat, but a metaphoric retreat as well. The pastoral as chameleon enables us to inhabit a distinct, coherent world that does not exclude the possibility of other worlds. It supplies a hall of mirrors. Once I started writing, to poke away both at my own nostalgic recreation of the countryside and what presently it meant to be living in that environment for real, the more I realised how inextricably the nostalgic impulse, the searching for home, for that unidentifiable thing that had been lost, is bound up in the very act of writing itself. The muses, if we needed reminding, are the daughters of memory. Ted Hughes in the poem Pike shows how memory can be the active principle of creation. Introducing the poem, Hughes tells us that it came about as a substitute for going fishing, arose, in fact, as I remembered the extreme pleasures of that sport. He continues, by looking at the place in my memory very hard and very carefully, and by using the words that grew naturally out of the pictures and feelings, I captured not just a pike, I captured a whole pond, including the monsters I never even hooked. Hughes's pond is an actualised pond, but also a recognisable pastoral figure with distinctly Orwellian undertones. Stilled legendary depth, it was as deep as England. Towards the end of the poem, fishing becomes an extraordinary metaphor for the confrontation with the unremembered, the half-remembered. The past, Hughes seems to be saying, is alive, and if it doesn't catch you first, catch it as you can. He describes, owls hushing the floating woods, frail on my ear against the dream, darkness beneath night's darkness had freed that rose slowly toward me, watching. James Salter, a contemporary American novelist, when asked the question, why do you write, replies, there comes a time when you realise that everything is a dream, and only those things preserved in writing have any possibility of being real. The impulse to write is the impulse to preserve, to rescue, and crucially to make real, not only to ourselves, but to one another. Hughes's pond, Shakespeare's Forest of Arden, the poem, the play, the novel, they all offer us a space out of quotidian time into which we might immerse ourselves, to reflect, recall, inform, and reform ourselves. An enterprising performance project recently came to Exeter, where I now live, from Leeds. Bring the Happy, it was called. From an empty shop on the high street, people were stopped and asked for their happiest memories. These were logged, mapped, and turned into a performance. What became evident very quickly was that happy memories were so often circumscribed with loss or regret, the part without which happy could not be defined. If you had to choose a venue for testing emotional weather, what more fitting place than the meteorological office? Here, performers dipped into the accumulated memories, quoting verbatim from the public's contributions, creating a public arena in which these moments were revisited and shared. Births, deaths, a wartime fumble, a waltz in a bingo hall, the act of recalling lit up the memory in a new space, brought it back to life under the combined battery power of an audience's attention. Here was living proof of the generative power of nostalgia, not a dead end or a one-way street, but a destination in its own right, resonant, alive and kicking. The pastoral is the place into which writers tap, to which readers head, the place where our mythologies, our shared and distinct narratives set up home, and as such it becomes intrinsic to that alchemical process that turns the written page into the world we recreate as we write and as we read. No one has put this more beautifully or succinctly than the metaphysical poet Andrew Marvell. In his poem The Garden, the mind becomes the true location of the pastoral. That ocean where each kind does straight its own resemblance find, yet it creates transcending these far other worlds and other seas, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. Pastoral sustains the paradox contained in that opposition of creates and annihilates. It is infinitely accommodating and at the same time miraculously, clarifyingly reductive. If we achieve nothing else, it is worth achieving this, he says, a green thought in a green shade, which stands, needless to say, for everything.
That was Jane Fever. You can find out more about Jane on the RLF website. Her surname is spelt F-E-A-V-E-R. Next, here's Catherine McMahon with
Location, Location, Location. So most people, as writers, are familiar with that moment when an idea suddenly takes root and becomes an absolute obsession. And that's exactly what happened when I began thinking about the nurses who went with Florence Nightingale to the Crimea at the start of the book which I wrote, which later became The Rose of Sebastopol. I'd not got far into the research, though, when I realised that, somewhat belatedly, that I, a non-Russian-speaking, woefully untravelled writer of the 21st century, was about to write about a 19th-century war which took place in what is now the Ukraine, a country I'd never seen and been to. So for some writers, the role of place comes much earlier in the creative process. Jill Dawson's novel, The Great Lover, which concerns Rupert Brooke, was actually inspired by Jill's visit to Grantchester's Orchard Tea Garden, where Brooke once lived. And she became aware of how old the trees were and how Brooke must have been shaded by them. And she watched the bees, and he must have done exactly the same. And in the same way, her novel Lucky Bunny, which is about a female London thief, began with childhood memories of Hackney and the flashy funeral of a master criminal that she'd actually witnessed. So for her, the understanding of the feel of a place, however much it may have changed superficially since the time about which she is writing, actually provides her with the imaginative spark. But when I was writing The Rose of Sebastopol, there wasn't any chance for me to visit the Crimea until the book was half written. And really, I think that was just as well, because at the start of writing, I just didn't know what I was looking for. The Crimean War is really richly documented as photographs, paintings, and there are first-hand accounts in diaries and letters and journalism. And there are really graphic descriptions, for example, in letters from Catholic nuns. They didn't go out with Florence Nightingale, but they went out in opposition to her, actually. So the novel rattled along for a while without it being a problem that I hadn't actually visited the Crimea. But then the moment comes when my heroine, who's called Mariella and she's very timid, actually sets foot in Balaclava Harbour, and I knew I had to go there. And I think that that timing is absolutely essential. I was talking to Tracy Chevalier, and she said she won't go nearer a location until she started writing, and then she knows exactly what question she needs to ask. So in the writing of The Girl with the Pearl Earring, it was really well advanced before she visited Delft, and she was then ready to soak up the atmosphere. And what she said was, you can get rid of the cars and the signs and see the old city. It's as if the place seeps into you, and being there comes out in ways that are really hard to pinpoint. Now, by a complete fluke, I found a ridiculously cheap package to the Crimea, and I arm-twisted a friend into joining me, and we set forth in a plane full of tourists. And we stayed in a massive ex-Soviet hotel in Yalta, and we saw the Crimea as it is now. It's a resort for rich Russians, really, and it's a place of displacement. It's constantly being invaded and fought over. But for me, it was absolutely thrilling because the package took us to the sites of the Crimean War, for instance, to Balaclava, which is a ridiculously small and confined harbour. But the entire British fleet was moored up there. And so there was one hurricane and it lost most of its ships and also most of their cargoes one winter. And we visited the Valley of Death, where the charge of the Light Brigade took place. And that's really a kind of wide and rather dull valley compared to the one described by Tennyson. But most evocative of all for me was the Battle of Inkerman site. And so our guide, she said, the problem, she said, was that the Russian general, when they fought the Battle of Inkerman, he had no map. There was a map, but it was 60 miles away in Simferopol. So both armies fought without a map. They were fighting blind in fog in a terrain which is in some ways much rockier and more extreme than the most rugged bits of Dartmoor. And so I made a discovery then which is totally unrelated to historical fact, because my novel was about a woman who goes missing in the Crimea, and I had absolutely no idea until I visited Inkerman what had happened to her. But when I saw that place, I suddenly realised, yes, that's what happened to Rosa. And it was like I'd known it all along. The most vital thing about being in the Crimea was literally the feel of the place. We arrived in October in warm sunshine, so it was t-shirt weather. But then a few days later, by the end of our time there, the temperature dropped so far that we could hardly bear to stand up in the open air. And these were exactly the conditions that the British Army had to put up with. When they disembarked, it was so warm and sunny that the general said, well, let's leave all the winter uniforms and the tents in the ships. And then that was really the start of an unfolding tragedy of total incompetence. And from a distance, the Crimea looks really enchanting and like a version of England. But actually, of course, it's a foreign country with a foreign climate. And all this went into my novel. I came home and I wrote about the cold and the wet and struggles against the elements. And my heroine, Mariella, saw a Sebastopol from the heights that I had stood upon. And I described the cave that I'd found in Inkerman. And as I wrote, my memories and the photographs were transformed again into a new version of what I'd seen, which became part of my fictional world. So my relationship with that landscape and the fact that I had been intimidated by the journey became my heroine's relationship. Perhaps the most extreme example of this kind of association between writer and character and place is in Steph Penny's book, The Tenderness of Wolves. So she told The Guardian in 2007 that she actually couldn't visit Canada because at the time she was suffering from agoraphobia. But she solved the problem by creating a landscape which she couldn't physically enter, partly by research and partly by creating an agoraphobic heroine. So she used her own relationship with landscape to create that very special atmosphere. Now, another example is when I visited Caen at the beginning of Season of Light, when I was writing a book set during the French Revolution. And my dad said to me, "Don't bother going there," he said. "We flattened Caen during the war." But I sniffed around the modern Caen and I had this half-written novel in my head. And I had this blurred kind of triple vision of my research, my emerging novel and the actual city. And I also found out about a very bright-eyed and alarming figure who'd actually lived there during the French Revolution. And she was called Charlotte Corday, who was the one who married Marat in his bath. And I was really surprised to find out that she was actually a daughter of Caen. And so though I was well into writing the book, it was only at that moment when I visited Caen and I visited the places that Corday had been educated in that I realised the jeopardy that my heroine would have been in if she'd happened to meet Corday in Caen too. And that's when I began a new sort of journey into the psyche of an 18th century terrorist, which was Charlotte Corday, and that goes into the book. So location is integral to historical fiction in particular because it gives it a firm and grounded sense of place, of time and of atmosphere. After all, whether a novel is set in the 16th or the 20th century, location, the ground beneath our feet, is what forms the root of our common experience with those who lived there in the past. We love Wuthering Heights, for example, which is an historical novel within a contemporary fiction because we, like its contemporary narrator, Lockwood, connect so powerfully with the landscape. And of course, historical fiction shares with all other genres of fiction in its very fluid relationship between actual and imagined places. But for the join to be invisible, the writer has to have a very deep and creative bond with both. Tracy Chevalier calls the writer's relationship with location part of the fairy dust that a writer sprinkles on her material. She says it's integral to the creative process and the vibrancy of the novel as it springs off the page. For a novel to be truly magical, the reader needs to feel utterly engrossed in the experience of the fictional world. Great historical fiction has nothing to do with setting a modern fiction against a historical background or rewriting history. It's about discovering a unique and unfolding story through the interplay between the contemporary writer's imagination and her or his understanding of the past. So, of course, style and plot and character are all part of the brew, but location is also key. Thus, the writer can evoke worlds far removed in time from our own, but connected to us by our actual experience of place and the sensations that never change, such as cold and dirt and sunshine, the quietness or stuffiness of an enclosed space, or the harshness of a city. When I remember my visit to the Crimea now, it's not simply in snatches of what I actually saw. Just as vivid is the story I told after I turned to my desk. So my novel is a palimpsest. My Rosa and her timid cousin Mariella, they flicker across a landscape which is both then and now, which exists in its present state and in its imagined past, and which lives and breathes for me and for my reader as a novel and created world.
That was Catherine McMahon. You can find out more about Catherine on her website at www.catherinemcmahon.com. That's Catherine with two A's and McMahon starting with MC. And that concludes episode 59, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 60, the non-fiction writer and novelist Alex Martin speaks with Carol Angier about his early writing career as he moves from children's writing through English language textbooks to the whimsical delights of decadence. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.